All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're taking a look at, well, murder for hire.
Always a good topic.
Yeah, keeps things interesting, right? And the case we're diving into, it's United States v. Dvorkin. It's a Seventh Circuit case, and it really digs into, like, the nuts and bolts of federal murder for hire law. Like, what does the government actually have to prove to put someone away for trying to, you know, hire a hitman?
Yeah, definitely a fascinating case. I mean, this one really gets into the weeds of 18 U.S.C. Section 1958, which is like the big federal statute aimed at stopping murder for hire.
Right.
And the thing that really struck me about this case, you know, as I was looking into it, is that it all started with, believe it or not, a fight over commercial real estate.
Oh, wow. So like a property deal gone bad.
Basically, yeah. So you have this guy, Daniel Dvorkin, and he gets slapped with a massive, like, $8.2 million judgment.
$8.2 million.
Yep. Owed it to a company called Texas 1845 LLC, which was run by a guy named Larry Meyer.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you can imagine the kind of financial pressure Dvorkin must have been under. And, well, that seems to be what set everything in motion.
Okay, so we have Dvorkin. He's in a really tough spot financially. That brings us to the actual laws in play here, right?
Right.
We've mentioned Section 1958.
1958, yeah.
But I think you said there's another statute involved, too.
There is, yeah. So Dvorkin was actually charged under two federal laws. You've got 18 U.S.C. Section 1958, which basically makes it illegal to use interstate commerce. So we're talking phones, emails, traveling across state lines, that kind of thing, to commit murder for hire. Then you've got 18 U.S.C. Section 373. That one deals with soliciting violent federal crimes. So both are definitely relevant to the case as a whole. But for our deep dive today, we're going to be focusing on 1958 and, you know, how the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals interpreted what it actually takes to break that law.
Gotcha. So focusing in on 1958. Now, what's the big legal question, the one that the appeals court had to wrestle with in this case?
The big question was all about, well, how much do you have to prove under 1958? You see, Dvorkin's lawyers, they argued that to get a conviction, the prosecution had to show there was an actual, like, signed, sealed, delivered agreement to pay someone for the murder. Like a real contract, you know?
A formal hitman contract.
Yeah, exactly. But the government, they were saying, no, no, no. The law only requires us to prove that the person intended to commit murder for hire and that they used interstate commerce, you know, to make it happen.
So, like, even taking a step towards it using, like you said, a phone call or an email.
Right. And that's a really crucial difference because it defines, you know, where the line is between thinking about doing something terrible and actually committing a federal crime.
I see. Yeah, that's a big difference. Okay, so we have the background. We've got the legal question. Now let's get to, you know, the actual events, what happened in this case.
All right, so rewind back to April 2012. Dvorkin, remember, he's dealing with this huge $8.2 million debt hanging over his head.
Right.
He goes and approaches a firearms dealer named Robert Bevis.
Okay.
And during their meeting, he offers Bevis $50,000 with, like, a chillingly straightforward instruction. He tells Bevis to, quote, make Larry Meyer stop breathing.
Well, make Larry Meyer stop breathing. I mean, that's pretty direct. That doesn't leave much room for interpretation, does it?
Nope, not at all. I mean, that really drives home, you know, just how serious his alleged intent was.
Yeah.
And to back up his words, you know, make it clear he's not messing around, Dvorkin even shows Bevis a bunch of cash, like, you know, almost a down payment.
Wow.
And then later on, he gives Bevis Larry Meyer's LinkedIn profile, you know, probably to make sure there was absolutely no confusion about who he was targeting.
So Robert Bevis, this firearms dealer, he becomes kind of a central figure here.
He does, yeah.
So what happens? What does Bevis do with this information, this request from Dvorkin?
Well, this is where things take a turn. Bevis decides, you know what? I'm going to become an FBI informant. Yeah. He reports Dvorkin to the authorities, and from that point on, every meeting, every conversation they have, it's all recorded.
So they got him on tape, basically.
Exactly. And because of that evidence, Dvorkin ends up getting charged under both 1958 and 373.
So he's found guilty at trial, but he doesn't just, you know, accept the verdict, right?
Right.
He appeals. So what's the basis of his appeal? What's he arguing to the Seventh Circuit?
His main argument focused on how he interpreted the wording of, you know, Section 1958 specifically. His lawyers, they were saying that the law requires the prosecution to prove not just that Dvorkin wanted a murder to happen, but that he had actually made a concrete, finalized agreement to pay for it. Like, it wasn't enough to just express the desire or even offer money. There had to be like a formal acceptance of the offer, you know, all the terms laid out and agreed upon.
So basically he was saying just talking about it, even with money on the table, isn't enough.
Exactly. Without a formal agreement, in his view, it wasn't a crime under that specific statute.
Interesting. And I'm guessing the government had a different take on that.
Oh, absolutely. They fired back, you know, saying Dworkin's interpretation of the statute was flat out wrong. Their argument was that 1958 only requires proof that the defendant, in this case Dworkin, had the intent to have someone murdered for money, and that they used interstate commerce to further that intent. They were basically saying, look, a formal contract, you know, that's not a necessary element of the crime under this law.
Okay, so a real clash over what the law actually requires. So how did the Seventh Circuit rule? Who did they side with?
Well, the Seventh Circuit sided with the government. They said, point blank, that 1958 does not require an actual murder for hire agreement to be in place.
So they upheld his conviction?
Yes.
Okay, so let's dig a little deeper into their reasoning. How did they get to that conclusion?
Well, their reasoning really boiled down to the actual wording of the statute. 1958, it says, and I'm quoting here, traveling in or using any facility in interstate or foreign commerce with intent that a murder be committed as consideration for a promise or agreement to pay.
Okay, so they're focusing on those specific words.
Right. And they interpreted that phrase, consideration for a promise or agreement to pay, as describing the kind of intent that's required, specifically the intent to have a murder committed for money. It doesn't mean, in their view, that there has to be an actual legally binding contract in place.
Oh, I see. So the intent has to be tied to payment, but it doesn't have to be a fully executed, like, you know, lawyer-approved contract.
Exactly. And the court really emphasized that the heart of the crime is using interstate commerce to try and make this happen. So, like, making that phone call, sending that email across state lines, those are the actions the statute is going after. And it doesn't matter, at least according to the Seventh Circuit, whether a formal agreement was ever reached.
So using those channels for a murder for hire, that's the key.
Right.
Okay, so the agreement itself isn't the make or break point. Now, I remember reading that they also looked at another federal law, something kind of similar, to back up their thinking.
Yeah, they did. They compared 1958 to the Travel Act.
The Travel Act.
Yeah, which is 18 U.S.C. section 1952A. And they pointed out that 1958 was actually modeled after the Travel Act. And here's the thing. The Travel Act also doesn't specifically say that there needs to be a formal agreement in place for whatever illegal activity the person's traveling for.
Huh. So no agreement requirement in the Travel Act either.
Nope. And the Seventh Circuit, their reasoning was that if Congress wanted that to be a requirement in 1958, they would have put it in there just like they could have with the Travel Act.
Right. If it's not explicitly stated, it's probably not a requirement. So going back to Dworkin, what did they point to as proof of his intent?
Well, they highlighted several things. His conversations with Beavis, where they talk about the $50,000 payment, that direct statement, make Larry Meyer stop breathing, showing the cash to Beavis, and even giving him Meyer's LinkedIn profile, you know, so there's no mistake. They were saying, taken all together, these actions clearly show that Dworkin wanted Meyer dead and he was willing to pay for it. So even though they didn't actually finalize a deal with Beavis, his intent was crystal clear.
Got it. He took concrete steps towards making it happen. And I think there was a quote from the court's opinion that really sums up their view.
There is. The opinion, written by Judge Ripple, says, quote, Section 1958 does not require proof of an actual murder for hire agreement, but rather only that the defendant act with the intent that a murder for hire be committed, end quote.
Okay, that's a pretty clear statement. So, zooming out a bit, what does this ruling mean for how we understand federal murder for hire law? What's the takeaway here?
The big takeaway is that prosecutors, when they're bringing charges under 1958, don't need to prove that there's a full-on, you know, legally binding contract for murder. Instead, they have to prove that the defendant used interstate commerce with the intent to have someone killed for money.
So it clarifies the law, and it might even make it easier to prosecute people who, you know, take steps towards setting up a hit, even if they don't actually finalize all the detail.
Right. It really shifts the focus from a formal agreement to showing clear intent and actions taken, you know, using interstate communication or travel.
Right. So the agreement isn't the be-all, end-all. It's about the intent and the steps taken using interstate commerce to try to make it happen. And that's a huge difference, right? It means law enforcement can step in earlier, potentially before someone actually gets hurt.
Yeah, definitely. It allows them to act, you know, potentially prevent a tragedy without having to wait for a contract to be drawn up and signed.
Okay, so Just to sum up our deep dive into United States v. Dvorkin, the Seventh Circuit said that to prove a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1958, the government has to prove that the defendant used interstate commerce with the intention of having a murder committed for pay. They don't need to prove there was a final agreement.
That's it in a nutshell. The focus is really on the intent and using interstate facilities to try and make that intent a reality.
So here's a thought for you to ponder. Given this ruling, where do we as a society draw the line between someone saying something awful and actually committing a federal crime? Does focusing so much on intent, especially when combined with, you know, something as common as interstate communication, really differentiate between serious crimes and, well, maybe someone just blowing off steam or making disturbing but ultimately empty threats?
Wow. Yeah, that's a really thought-provoking question. Amen. I mean, it gets to the heart of those tricky areas where the law is trying to get inside someone's head, you know, criminalizing intent. That always leads to some really interesting debates.
It sure does. Well, that's all the time we have for our deep dive today. Thanks for joining us as we explore the ins and outs of United States v. Dvorkin. Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning.